You may be seated. Thank you. The third case set for argument this morning is a consolidated set of cases, number of individuals as plaintiffs versus Summit Carbon Transport, LLC. Before I introduce and acknowledge the lawyers, I want to acknowledge Judge Janeway Fifely from the 7th Judicial Circuit Court, who is sitting with us today. Justice Devaney has disqualified herself from the case, and we appreciate Judge Whiff-Fifely sitting with us today. The lawyers that will be arguing the cases this morning, Brian Jordry will be arguing on behalf of the appellant landowners. Brett Doblinsky will be arguing on behalf of Summit Carbon Solutions. Each side will have 20 minutes for your initial argument. And then, Mr. Jordry, you'll have a 10-minute rebuttal. So with that, Mr. Jordry, you may proceed with your argument.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice and Justices. My name is Brian Jordy, and it's my pleasure to appear here today with Mr. Nicholas Mosier on behalf of landowners.
So let me stop you just for a minute. We just had this debate before we came out, and I was saying it was Jordy, but then there's some places where it says Jordry.
One of my clients is Jordry.
Okay.
And they're one of the lead in one of the cases. So
it's Jordy.
I'm Jordy.
All right.
Yes, but I'll answer to anything. So in any event, it's our pleasure to be here before you today. And we're here on a very important issue, and that is the challenge statute 213531 is facially unconstitutional because it allows and authorizes a physical taking against the will of the property owner. It allows an entry, which is a taking itself under Cedar Point, and it allows for occupation and further invasion and invasive and other surveys. So Cedar Point did change the landscape. It's 2021 U.S. Supreme Court case. Prior to that, the analysis on takings was a Loretto analysis, and Loretto said, is it a permanent physical taking? Is it a permanent physical invasion? And then that would be a taking. What Cedar Point does, it expands Loretto, and it says the intermittency or the temporal nature is not a distinguishing factor in whether a taking has occurred. So when the government or its delegee, here a proposed carbon pipeline company, invades property, it appropriates the right to exclude. What we know from our Supreme Court case law and jurisprudence is that the right to exclude is one of the most cherished of the bundle of sticks when we think of property rights. In fact, ownership is a defined term in South Dakota law, and that is the ability to use and possess at the exclusion of others. So the very fundamental reason why we're here, well, it's two things. One is the entry, the breach of my property, which is mine, is a physical taking regardless of, again, the temporal nature.
So let me inquire about this. So the statute talks about survey and examination, and currently the existing statute doesn't define examination, but surveying is pretty typical in these condemnation cases. Governmental entity goes in and surveys the property and leaves. Do you differentiate between what would be considered a traditional survey and some of the other testing that may be taking place on the property?
I think that's a fair point. I am not conceding that just walking around is not a taking. I think Cedar Point says that, in fact, is a taking. However, if we go a step further, a invasive, destructive type of survey, drilling, boring, trenching, replacing drillings with cement and a permanent taking, that is clearly invasive, and there's no common law in this state that justifies that at all.
So, counsel, the second prong exception inside Cedar Point, where many, the case itself recognizes this longstanding background restriction on property, it's not your view that the standard, most minimally intrusive entry would fall within that exception to go in and look at the property, survey the boundaries, without soil or minimal soil disturbance. That's not, in your view, within that exception in Cedar Point?
That's on a case-by-case basis. And so Cedar Point, you picked up on the second. There's three that they talk about background principles, which evolve from Lucas. And the examples are, for instance, a fleeing felon, and the police are running across your front yard, right? An emergent situation. A flood is coming, and the National Guard is going to sandbag my front yard. They don't have to go to the court petition for condemnation. But what Cedar Point says is that when you appropriate the right to exclude, that's a taking period. Now, can it be saved if a background principle concept exists? And I think that's where you're headed. That depends on state law. The Palazzolo, Lucas, they're very clear that it's the state's legal tradition and history. So we don't do a survey of what they do in Minnesota, Nebraska, or Georgia, or any other case. That doesn't matter. What other states have done in terms of surveys or whatever statutes they may have is of no moment and no relevance when we determine South Dakota's legal tradition. And the legal jurisprudence tradition, in for the purposes of background principles, is foiled against the citizens' historic understanding of what they would believe is an impediment or restriction to title. And if we were to survey, which we're not, the whole state, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a reasonable landowner to think, well, sure, obviously when I bought this, I knew a pipeline company could come on in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and do invasive, destructive, or even minimally invasive surveying, and I had no say-so, and I'm not compensated for the entry. No one would think that is a background principle. And there's no common law. Importantly, there is no common law in this state to establish it. And Palazzolo says at 2464 that a mere statute, a mere law, does not create a background principle.
But you pointed out that Cedar Point departed from the traditional analysis that a temporary interaction with the property is not a taking. But you also said that it should be a case-by-case analysis. In Cedar Point, it isn't just a one-time walking on to survey the property. It's you have to allow the union onto the property three times a week for every week or something along those lines. Much more intrusive. Why would we extend that Cedar Point analysis to this one-time intrusion for the traditional survey?
I would, with respect, push back on the one time. If we read the law, and this is a facial challenge, the law has no limitation as to duration, frequency, or the amount of surveys. Under the law right now, a 30-day letter is sent out. They don't even have to prove that it was received by landowner or tenant. They just say, we sent it. And there is no limitation. So I send you one 30-day letter. I can survey every second of every day till the end of time. Now, you might say, well, but is that likely to happen? We're not talking about speculation of how the law, a poor law, may be used. On the face of it, there's no limitation. So I argue with respect that the current statute is more invasive, more intrusive than the Cedar Point statute. At least there, it was defined an hour before work started, an hour during lunch, and an hour after work. There was no intrusion or implication on the business activities of that nursery in Cedar Point. It was a defined time when union organizers would be here. You didn't have to go see them. It didn't impact the business. Here, they can come in the middle of harvest. They can come in the middle of planting. They can tear up fields. They can do anything. And so I argue this statute on its face, again, facial challenge, is worse than and more wandering and more invasive than Cedar Point.
The California statute at issue in Cedar Point was what might be termed a freestanding right of entry. It was unconnected to any other principle or set of rules that would allow someone to enter onto another person's land. That doesn't seem to be the case here. It seems like lurking very much in the context in the background is the right to exercise eminent domain, and I know we have issues on whether we have commodity and whether we have common carrier,
yes.
And depending upon how those are resolved, this may or may not come to pass.
Right.
But it seems very much different, depending upon how those issues are determined, than the freestanding right that was at issue in Cedar Point. What do you think?
Well, I think that argument lost in front of the U.S. Supreme Court in Cedar Point. And whether it's an ordinance, restriction, decree, or statute, common law, doesn't matter. We go right back to the invasion. Is the invasion, is there a physical invasion? Is there an appropriation by government or delegee of the right to refuse entry? And if so, taking. Done. It's right there. Now, if, go ahead.
No, but at a minimum, and I agree, and I'm not arguing one way or the other. I'm just suggesting some thoughts. But would at a minimum, would that explain that that general background principle that seems to be implicated here that we've talked about and you've talked about, Justice Kern, already? At a minimum, would that relationship to the power of eminent domain, would it be appropriate to view that within a larger context of state law that allows for that?
Well, I think no. And here's why. I can have a piece of thread, but until I do something with it, it doesn't become useful. It doesn't become a garment, a blanket. You can have a stale statute that's sitting out there. There's no evidence, again, there's no common law that any of those statutes have actually been used against the will of people, that if cases come up to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court has said what the common law is. Absent the common law and a robust legal tradition, it is not a background principle. So that would be my argument. Now, if you said, well, I think that's going too far, then certainly the invasive, any subsurface is an absolute no-go.
Well, that was my next question. If you lose on your all-or-nothing argument, and I know this isn't really your test to conceive, this is you have your argument, but what would be something that could be applied, a test or a standard that could be applied to something that was more invasive than walking the land, as we sometimes have said in these cases? Is it just the absolute per se, you do anything with the ground itself, that's taking?
So, again, if I'm relying on Cedar Point, the breach of the property, the appropriation of the right to refuse, they say that's a taking. Now, for purposes of your question, there's condemnation statutes already exist. And frankly, here, if they had just condemned an access easement, temporary access easement, back in May 2022, June, when these letters went out, they had already been on and off and done, compensation, proper notice, ability to appear and have due process. That's the test. The test is you already have laws in place, and they're in the condemnation code.
That's a procedure. That's not a test. I'm saying, have you thought of a test where something would breach what might be permissible? And I know you don't like that, but it would breach what's permissible, and it would enter into the realm of a taking. Is it just disturbing the land? Is it a proposal that would extract a core sample? Is that the standard?
Okay, now I'm understanding. Thank you for that. If I'm pushed to go there, any disturbance of soil, any subsurface examination, whatever that means, survey, whatever that means, undefined without limit under the current law, which again is why it's facially unconstitutional, one of the many reasons, that has to be it. If you wanted to take me back to 1895, when, frankly, it was a man and a mule going out and trying to figure out property boundaries, okay. But anything more than a surface view is absolutely a taking and not a background principle at all.
Can I have you move to the common carrier and the
yes,
and the
yes, thank
commodity.
You, certainly. So, I'd be happy to. It's 49.711. This entity, on the evidence at summary judgment, is clearly not a common carrier. They are not transporting a commodity, number one, and they're not transporting it for hire. They are a private carrier that offers carbon management solutions. It is clear from the offtake agreements at SR3 17, I think, 7, 8 and 1715, that their business model is not shipping something for someone else. And the lower courts erred when they concluded it was owned by or belonged to, I think was the phrase, the ethanol plants.
So they're saying, we're advertising to potential customers, we're holding this open season, we're reserving future pipeline capacity, and we're holding ourselves out to the general public as hire. Is that sufficient?
Absolutely not.
Tell me why.
Okay.
So, or us why?
Sure. I'll go to the Secretary of State later today, and I'll start Brian Drury Pipeline Company. I'll put a website up, one page, and I'll say Brian Drury Pipeline Company is holding himself out to the general public to transport a commodity for a higher period. That's the only content on the webpage. Do you think the law intended that now I can send a 30-day letter to anyone in this room and be tromping around their ground within 30 days? Absolutely not. The mere assertion that you are something doesn't mean you are. And the evidence submitted proves they are not. Their own evidence, the offtake agreement. There's the title transfer point. That's the critical piece in Section 8.01 of the transfer agreement. The title to the CO2 transfers from ethanol providers at the moment their carbon capture equipment starts.
Is that true 100% across the board?
It's true based on 100% of the evidence that they provided pursuant to the protective order.
So we have no other evidence in the record that says anything to the contrary?
Correct.
Other than an aspiration, perhaps, that there could be conceivably a theoretical third party that would engage them to transport CO2.
Which is not enough. I mean, how do you test that? You want to talk about a test. They're mere saying, well, maybe there's someone in the future that somehow might want to put product on this, and then we get back to commodity. You know, which I think they got the commodity definition wrong. And both commodity and the for hire piece were sua sponte rulings. We didn't have an opportunity to respond, and then the lower court just doubled down in their summary judgment, took no more evidence on that.
So is this waste? Can waste be a commodity? Can you address the commodity prong?
It's absolutely not a commodity. How is this an article for commerce? How is it it's not being added to a product for beneficial use? The test isn't, can carbon dioxide somewhere on planet Earth be used for pop or be used for whatever it is? It's what are you transporting? You are claiming you're a common carrier. You tell us how the CO2 that you're moving is a commodity. If I transport waste that otherwise would go up into the atmosphere and I capture it and now I put it in a hole in North Dakota, that doesn't make it an article of commerce. There's no payment exchange for the CO2 by anyone under their offtake agreements.
Can you speak to the other states that have found to the contrary? Now, there are four or five states and the federal government apparently that have found SCS, carbon capture, to be common carrier and carbon to be a commodity.
I'm not aware of any of those. Of the federal decision determining that they are, in fact, a common carrier?
It's in the briefs. I'll pull it out for you here. Go ahead with your argument.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'd have to look directly at how they're
if there's a federal definition that classifies CO2 as a commodity, that's sure. In the briefs. Could you start there?
Well,
okay. Because you said earlier you think that they got the definition of commodity wrong, so maybe...
Well, okay. And so what I don't want to get lost on is a definition of CO2 over here absent and untethered to how it's actually being utilized and transported and used here. Those are two different things. I concede that carbon dioxide, if put to a beneficial use, if it becomes part of an article of commerce, is therefore a commodity. We might be able to trade it, purchase it, etc. In this instance, and why it's important what they're doing here in South Dakota, is because that triggers the 49711. It's not saying if CO2 is a commodity anywhere on planet Earth. It's saying we are transporting a commodity through your state. Well, then what do the offtake agreements say? They don't support that whatsoever. And their admission that they're permanently sequestering this forever, it can never be used. It can't be traded.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So as part of that argument, the idea that this particular CO2 that we're talking about or this proposed pipeline envisions goes to a terminal point at a permanent sequestration facility. And so I don't want to get into Commerce Clause cases, but it's really not in the stream of commerce at that point. And I know that's not the right test, but it's not being used or would it? I mean, there's nothing in the record that suggests it would be used at that point.
Correct. It's not an article of commerce. It's captured from the air where it was clearly not a commodity as it's just off-gassing into the for the last 25 years from South Dakota ethanol plants. Now because we put it in a pipeline and instead of in the air, we pump it underground, now it becomes a commodity. It doesn't for purposes of their invocation of 49711.
So in their brief, they note that the federal government in several states, including Louisiana, Oklahoma, Mississippi, North Dakota, and Nebraska, have classified CO2 as a commodity, and that in 49 CFR 1039, it's listed as a commodity by the Surface Transportation Board. That's what I was referencing.
Okay, I'm sorry. When you put in that SCS, yes.
Sorry.
No, I 100% agree with that. Their business model, how they're transporting a commodity on a per-state basis when they're using it as a term of art to get privileges under this common carriage, that hasn't been decided by anywhere. I mean, this is going to be the first impression in the country on that issue, whether this CO2 heading for permanent sequestration is in fact a commodity.
So in these other locations, it's being utilized in some other fashion, not solely fracking?
Fracking, EOR almost exclusively, enhanced oil recovery almost exclusively.
And not exclusively for sequestration. That's helpful. Thank
correct,
you.
Correct.
May I inquire, in October of 22, SCS moved for a protective order and said in there, I think it was page 12, there are two factual issues. Is this a commodity, and are we holding ourselves out to the public as engaged in the business of transporting this product? What changed from when they admitted there were two questions of fact to when Judge Party said in December that, in fact, decided it was a commodity and a common carrier?
Good question. That's partly what brings us here. Judge Party had a redacted copy of the offtake agreement. He apparently read it without the benefit of briefing, without the benefit of a hearing, without the benefit of evidence, without the benefit of depositions or discovery, which we never got, despite umpteen requests. And then just sua sponte on December 28th, 2022, determined that he has found it is a commodity and it's for hire and it's over. And so we come to summary judgment and he's already made those findings. We didn't get depositions. We had a motion to continue. That was rejected. We had nowhere to go at that point. I don't know what happened other than he satisfied himself in that instance without evidence and argument that they were transporting a commodity for hire.
So Judge Party did not have the unredacted copy?
My understanding is he did not have the unredacted copy. I don't know that for sure. My understanding, it was a redacted copy. But even if he had the unredacted copy, that makes it worse. Because in the provision 3, I think 0.02, the off-taker, and then the title transfer point, it's absolutely clear that SCS takes title as soon as the CO2 emits from the ethanol plant. They are transporting what they own. They are a private, for-profit carrier, and they do not have the protections of 49.711.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Belinsky, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Brett Dublinsky with Frederickson and Byron on behalf of SCS Carbon Transport. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I appreciate the public that's come out for the term away from your home office. I want to pick up with some of the discussion that you just had with Mr. Jordy, because I think it's important that, on the one hand, the appellants concede that this is a facial challenge, but then want to spend an awful lot of time talking about specifics. So in response to a question from Justice Kern, Mr. Jordy said, well, that's on a case-by-case basis. That admission is fatal to his facial challenge, right? That's fundamentally the ultimate problem in this case. And let me start out with sort of the big picture, and that is the appellant's arguments take the proper framework and turn it absolutely upside down. The case law is abundantly clear, whether we're talking federal constitution, whether we're talking South Dakota, that there is a strong presumption of constitutionality of a duly adopted legislative act as a matter of separation of powers, and that as part of the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, that the task of the court is to look and ask, is there a way to construe this that harmonizes it with the Constitution? What the appellants are asking this court to do is exactly the opposite of that. They want you to add new tests, new criteria, new standards that do not have textual support in any constitutional provision, in any relevant statute, in any controlling case. And they want you to engage in an extension of Cedar Point that would make this court an extraordinary outlier. We cite in our brief, in a footnote at page 9, footnote 6, that a litany of cases that have applied Cedar Point since it was issued have all declined to extend and, in fact, have given it a narrow reading tied to its labor law facts. And I think if you look at the concurrence there by Justice Kavanaugh, who also emphasizes labor law as part of what's happening in that case, this case is very, very different. I think if you read Cedar Point correctly, there are a couple of places where we disagree with the appellants that are quite important. One, appellants want you to essentially read out the exception. It is not a taking to begin with if it is part of a traditional background restriction on property, number one. Number two, and I think Justice Salter discussed this point, and we agree, that it is extremely relevant that this is in the context of eminent domain. So Mr. Jordy argued, well, look, there's this list of examples in Cedar Point, and it's really narrow, right? It talks about chasing a criminal onto your property or what have you. But there's a couple of problems with that argument. One, the plain language of Cedar Point makes clear that that list is not exclusive. Second, Cedar Point refers back to Lucas versus South Carolina Coastal Commission for the development of this idea of a traditional background principle. And if you go back to Lucas, what that court says about it is that it can include traditional property or nuisance law. It contemplates that traditional exercise of state police power, even to the extent of commercial regulation, can be part of the traditional background principles. And the court in that case even notes that a landowner should expect from time to time that there will be new legislative developments consistent with pre-existing state powers. And it's that notion of consistent with pre-existing state powers that goes back to what Justice Salter mentioned on eminent domain. I don't think anybody can deny that eminent domain is a traditional background principle with respect to the ownership of land. That concept goes back, it's in the U.S. Constitution, it's in South Dakota's Constitution, it goes back virtually to the original constitutions of nearly every state. And so the question here, in a very important way, is much less broad than, is there a traditional background principle? And instead, properly framed, is pre-condemnation survey simply an implementation step in the exercise of that pre-existing background principle? And at this point, setting law aside, which I can get back to in a minute, I think there's a common sense aspect of it, and the court shouldn't be required to sort of leave common sense at the door. It's hard for me to ask what to condemn if I can't get on the property and properly figure that out, right? Condemnation should and does require a very specific description of the rights being condemned for the benefit not only of the landowner but of all future takers, right, future buyers, what have you. You need to know that with some specificity. And you can't get that without a pre-condemnation survey.
So the parties seem to, pardon me.
Sure.
The parties seem to contemplate or confront each other in this dispute in, I don't want to say more absolute terms, but more all or nothing terms. It's a taking or it's not a taking. And you heard some of the questions from Mr. Jordy. Is there a question of degree among what might be an examination or survey, and is it only a question of degree, or does it at some point eclipse the threshold of what might be permissible and enter into an impermissible taking? And of course, this is that discussion we were having as walking land versus digging and a 7 to 10 foot trench.
Sure.
And I know the parties are kind of dug in where they're dug in, but I'd be grateful for your thoughts and along those lines.
Yeah, I would be happy to discuss that, Justice Salter, and let me answer that in two ways. I think there are some shades and gradations that I'm happy to get into and talk through the hypothetical. But I want to start with the fact that, again, this is a facial challenge. If there is any survey that could be conducted as a pre-condemnation survey that would be constitutionally permissible, the facial challenge fails. So, yes, it's an important issue, I think, intellectually about these different types of survey, but for purposes of this case, the constitutional dimension, it's irrelevant. If simply walking the land as a survey would be valid, facial challenge fails. That's the nature of a facial challenge. To answer your question, I certainly don't mean to duck it by making that point. I think it's very clear that the surface survey is permissible. I think there is some dispute in the law once you start doing, for example, core samples. But I actually think SCS Carbon has the better argument there. If you take a look even at the treatises, for example, that Mr. Jordy cites, you know, they talk about there is some point that you cross a line, but it's not immediate. And I think context is important, right? This is for an underground pipeline. It isn't useful necessarily for its intended purpose unless you can, in some cases, figure out what's going on below the soil. And we didn't cite this case in our brief. I'm happy to provide it as supplemental authority. But interestingly, the U.S. Supreme Court, less than a week after Cedar Point was issued, issued a case called Penn East Pipeline. Chief Justice Roberts wrote that as well. And it is a lavish discussion about the history of eminent domain and the history of eminent domain use for pipelines. And it talks about the problem if the pipeline certificate isn't worth the paper it's written on because you can't use condemnation. So again, I think there's this recognition that there are certain things that you have to be able to do to build publicly valuable infrastructure. So I think that context is important. And I would note that other courts, right next door in North Dakota, for example, we cite in our brief 2015 application, another case, Cass County versus Olland, that said that core samples, even multiple core samples, are permissible and are on the right side, if you will, of, you know, where it becomes too intensive. One thing I want to point out, and I'm always leery of citing a justice's own case back to them, but I think that the closest analog here, while it's not an appellate case, was the Dakota Access case below. And my understanding of Dakota Access was that in that case, the court found that surface surveys were fine and did not reach the issue of subsurface work because it lacked an evidentiary record. And I would point out that here, the letters, the 30-day notice letters that are in the record, not only describe the specific survey techniques that will be engaged in for that specific property, but give a little discussion of why. So, you know, for example, we did aerial, and it was determined that because of some water patterns, there is, you know, a need to do more extensive cultural survey on your property. That's a more robust record than was present in Dakota Access. I think all of this, so you get, again, the Olland case.
Counsel, I'd like to, I don't want you to miss the opportunity to speak about common, whether or not SCS should qualify as a common carrier, and whether or not we're a case of first impression, yep. And whether or not carbon's a commodity.
No, I will turn to that in one sentence.
Very good. I hate to interrupt you, but we're
limited. No.
Thank you.
But in Olland, they make a distinction in the North Dakota Supreme Court between permanent survey markers or monuments and these core samples or relatively small underground survey methodology. So we think that all the surveys that we're looking to conduct are on the right side of that. I appreciate the reminder to get to common carrier and commodity. Again, I think this is another example where the appellants are asking you to do a vigorous search for additional conditions to attach to reject the legislature's legislation or to find it unconstitutional. Again, I think as a framework, that's inappropriate. But for example, the suggestion that, you know, a commodity is judged on what each precise shipper is doing with it and on what and which precise end user is doing with it, we would suggest is not appropriate, and it's not supported anywhere in any of the law. A commodity is a commodity is a commodity. That's, frankly, definitionally why it's a commodity, right? There's a lot of different definitions about, you know, economic good and it, does it have a value? I come from an economics background. We look at it as, is it a substitutable good, right? So you've got these, you know, commodities being traded, and they're largely substitutable. Carbon dioxide, every molecule of it looks the same, right? So, again, it fits all the tests of commodities in general, but it also fits it here, right? This is, in fact, moving in commerce.
Well, are you purchasing the carbon from the plants and then sequestering it? And yeah. is that a situation of first impression in the country?
We are not purchasing.
We are getting the federal tax credit.
So there is an economic model, and the economic value of the tax credits, I think, goes in part to the commodity question, right? Yes. This carbon has a value, whether it's tradable as credits, whether it's the federal government's willingness to pay for that to happen through tax credits. But on the common carrier issue, which is related to that, let me start with this. The issue about title, I think, is a red herring. You'll read lots of cases in lots of jurisdictions that talk about, is there an unrelated shipper? And the point of that is, if I am extracting oil or if I am growing wheat and I'm providing the rail car or the pipeline to move that, there is nobody other than me in that transaction. That is not true here. SCS doesn't create any carbon dioxide. It doesn't have any carbon dioxide of its own. There is an agreement to ship the carbon dioxide created by the ethanol plants for the benefit of the ethanol plants, and certainly SCS gets a benefit from that too. I'm not denying that. I want to be a little careful here because the details of this are all in sealed parts of the record. But I think it's fair, as the court pointed out in its own synopsis in the brochure for today, the agreements and the letters of intent between SCS and the counterparties have a tipping and transport charge. I don't see how that's not dispositive of the question. We are holding ourselves out as shipping CO2 from point to point for a fee. There is a charge, and the law says that can be direct or indirect, that is being paid by the producer of the carbon dioxide, the ethanol plant, for the transport of that ethanol. Now, appellants, again, I don't mean to sound like a broken record here, but want to add to the statute, which simply says holding out. That's what the statute says, what the case law says. The appellants want you to say, you know, they have to prove they're actually doing it, which makes it awfully hard for a new entrant to get into the market. Right? That is not a practical requirement, and it's not a requirement supported by law. It is undisputed that we were holding ourselves out as willing to transfer to transport for people in the relevant public, which are ethanol plants and large producers of carbon dioxide. So, again, we think the only way that there's a problem with that issue is if you continue to add additional requirements that are simply not supported by law, and again, are contrary to this effort to uphold the legislation and to avoid a constitutional problem.
So is this a case of first impression, then, whether or not the sequestration of carbon that's not being withdrawn or used in any other fashion would be a commodity?
I would agree that defined as narrowly as you just did, Your Honor, I think that part is a first impression. Right? Does the sequestration somehow change what is otherwise not an issue of first impression, that CO2 is a commodity.
So here it's waste, it's being sequestered, and the question is, can that be deemed a commodity?
Correct, and I would even carve out the waste part, right? If I'm shipping scrap steel, I think that's a commodity, even though it's waste from the original use. And again, whether or not this is waste or just simply a byproduct that has other commercial uses, including a commercial value when sequestered, I think makes it less of an issue of first impression. But we would acknowledge that that specific question, does the sequestration change anything about the commodity analysis, will be a matter of first impression.
Could I ask a question about the involvement? I'm trying to get this right in my mind. Does the for-hire component of being a common carrier, is it impacted? You said title doesn't matter, but is it impacted by the availability of these federal tax credits?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The slightly more robust definition of for-hire is not in the pipeline statute, but in the railroad statute. And it talks about direct or indirect, and I think there's case law that supports that as well. The fact that there is a tipping and transportation fee, I think, is where the for-hire comes in, regardless of the federal tax credit. The tax credit is part of the value for both the ethanol plant that is creating the carbon dioxide and for SCS carbon transport. Although it's certainly not the only source of value, I just want to be very clear about that. And for both of those reasons, I don't think that impacts the analysis.
When you rely on that railroad statute, doesn't Chapter 41 say that specifically doesn't apply to this?
It does, Your Honor, but then there's also no other definition here. And again, I think the case law supports the direct or indirect compensation. Compensation is interpreted broadly in terms of for hire. And so here, there's contemplation of a tipping and transportation fee. That is a compensation for the point-to-point carriage for carbon dioxide that's created by a counterparty. We believe that's all that's required.
Are the unredacted offtake agreements in the record?
The unredacted?
Yes.
They are not. They were viewed, an unredacted was viewed in camera, but those unredacted are not in the record. Obviously, the terms about, for example, tipping and transportation is known to the court.
The circuit court saw the unredacted, but this court does not have access to it.
That's correct. It was viewed in camera by the circuit court as part of the discovery dispute. And, again, the discovery dispute has a very high bar of abuse of discretion.
Do you object to this court directing your client to submit it or submitting it on behalf of your client?
For in-camera review?
Yes, by this court.
I don't think we have any problem with in-camera review. We do have some commercial concerns about opposing counsel and parties obtaining that, but for in-camera review, we'd be willing to do that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Polinsky. You can proceed with rebuttal, Mr. Jordy.
Yes, thank you. If I could pick up where Mr. Dublinsky started, the case-by-case basis, what I'm talking about is the background principle analysis, because that has to be done on a specific state's legal history and tradition. So I just wanted to make that clear.
But on that topic, and also as it relates to maybe your argument about commodity and common carrier, because you had some rather fact-specific and fact-bound arguments about that too, commodities, uses, that sort of thing, transporting your own CO2, not someone else's. Is the relief then that you would request, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have your brief up right now, but is the relief that you would request would be to reverse those grants of summary judgment, remand, and then what, have a trial on the full panoply of all those issues?
Well, my requested relief in the reply is to strike down the challenge survey statute as unconstitutional and direct the trial court to enter an order as saying such, and then for the Supreme Court to find that they are not transporting a commodity for hire.
What about that standard, though, that is really formidable for facial attacks and facial challenges? And I meant to ask you when you were up here earlier, under no conceived circumstance could a statute be applied constitutionally. I think that is the test.
Well, in terms of taking, we still have to do the takings analysis. I mean, whether it's a statute or an ordinance or whatnot. But I don't think this statute on its face can be applied, even in the situations we were talking about earlier. Again, it's a roving, unspecified, unconstrained, limitless right with the phrase as necessary. They can examine and survey as necessary. So the statute on its face gives way too much power and invites the taking. And then Cedar Point, again, we go right back to if I am appropriating your right to exclude, that's a taking, period. Cedar Point says that. On the background principles, this, for instance, in the DAPL decision pre-Cedar Point, I'm not going to speak for Justice Salter, but it appeared to me that you looked outside of South Dakota because South Dakota had no common law history. Well, South Dakota still doesn't have a common law history. So what my opponents don't want to talk about, they mentioned Lucas and background principles, but they didn't add in Palo Zolo in 2001, which came along and further clarified Lucas, which again says that mere enactment of a law is not enough to create a background principle. And so if we combined Lucas, the public emergent standards to an entry, the fleeing felon, those type of things, and then we say a statute alone isn't enough, and we look to the state's legal history, there is no common law period, end of sentence, on pre-condemnation survey entry right of access cases. So there is no legal tradition in this state. Those, whether a statute exists hasn't been tested. It's not a part of a robust citizen's understanding of what the jurisprudence is and that when they take title, they are automatically constrained.
So what sort of showing would, in regards of burdens or anything like that, but what sort of showing would suffice in that regard if a statute won't?
But if a statute won't, common law, robust decisions, multiple common law decisions related to that interpretation, something that's so ingrained in the fabric of a state's jurisprudence that it is obvious, just like a Fourth Amendment right of entry, the fleeing felon, the emergent situation, the public nuisance, the abatement of a nuisance, if you yourself are creating it on your property, the police don't have to go to the condemnation court and get an easement. Those kind of things that are so obvious. None of the exceptions even get close in Cedar Point or any of the progeny to touch on what they want to do here. I would like to get to a little bit more on the common carrier and the for hire issue. I think if you receive the unredacted copy, and there's no evidence in the record that Judge Party reviewed an unredacted copy. Maybe he did. I can't remember. But I don't think there's any evidence of that. But again, even if he did, that makes the ruling worse with respect. But 49.711 says they have to be engaged in the business of transporting commodities for hire. The question isn't if in the ether is CO2 a commodity. Are they in the business of transporting a commodity? So what are they doing? What are they transporting? How is that transportation happening? Who is the end user? No one. What is happening? Is it put to a beneficial use? So you do look specifically for purposes of their invocation of public use common carriage to the statute, and there is no evidence that they are in the business of transporting a commodity, and there's zero evidence that it's for hire.
So, and I'm out of my depth on this, so correct me if I'm wrong, but Is there an argument that the existence of the federal tax credits doesn't, it's not so much a question of hire, it's a question of whether they're just buying it and shipping it away. And they're using as part of their business model the existence of these credits, which make economic sense for them to do it. But without that, they really wouldn't be transporting it. I probably haven't said it very well.
No, I understand what you're saying. I mean, again, big picture, ethanol plants, for 25 years are emitting carbon. Okay, great. Now a company comes along and says, wow, we can make money if we get that carbon, run it through our equipment where we take title and own it. It goes through the capture equipment. Now it hits our pipeline, which we own. So we own the CO2, we own the capture equipment, we own the pipeline, and we own where it's going. That's a private carrier. That's not a common carrier.
Like there, Amazon.
There is. Thank you. Like Amazon, precisely. United States Postal Service. They don't take ownership of the sweater I send to my nephew. Okay, that's still mine. They are a common carrier for a fee, and the fees are published, and everyone knows what a stamp costs, what the costs are. Amazon takes title in the warehouse to Brian Jordy's trinket shop, and I use Amazon, but they take title. They have ownership when they deliver it to your door. Completely different. They're a private carrier. They're in a joint venture with the ethanol plants on a carbon management solution, which may lead to 45Q carbon tax credits. But in their offtake agreement, Summit SCS has the exclusive right to determine which money, government money, they're going to go after. They may not even go after 45Q. They might, the low carbon fuel standard might be higher. They're in total control. There's no common carriage. There's no for hire. And again, in the record, which is what we have, Mr. Dublinsky wants to talk about 100-plus pages they called an appendix, which was really ex parte evidence outside of the record, things they wish had been in the record but weren't. That you can't even consider any of that, regardless of what it says. I don't even know what it says. I didn't even read it. The point is, this record is devoid of for hire. It's devoid of commodity.
What about the tipping and transportation fee he just argued?
Zero evidence in the record. I defy anyone to show me where in the record that exists. It doesn't exist. And then what are all the terms? Let's look at the other 80 pages. What are all the notwithstanding that paragraph and this? I mean, you can't, with respect, go on that sojourn of a representation they just said that has no, there's no evidence. It wasn't considered by the lower courts. It didn't exist. That just pops up. And we had a five-month battle to try to get an unredacted copy, which we never got, of the offtake agreement, and they said this is all that exists, represented to the court. Now they come in front of you and say, but we have other agreements. We have other agreements that might save us. That doesn't cut it. That's not going to get the job done. So those are of no moment because they're not in the record whatsoever. There's simply no case, and this is all an issue of first impression. The DAPL decision in 2016, the appropriate analysis was done there. It was the Penn Central balancing. We balanced the, well, is it that bad? Is it not that bad? It was done well and thoughtfully. The Alland case, the North Dakota Brackey case 2015, those are all pre-Cedar Point. They applied the correct analysis under the prior test. But the current test says even an intermittent invasion is a taking, period. That's the law. They want to dance around it, say what it is, say what it isn't, but that's the law. And when they say it hasn't been extended, it's never been applied anywhere in this country yet, as we are doing it here, to this pre-condemnation alleged right. It's still a taking. They have a mechanism available. The sky will not fall. All they have to do is condemn a simple access easement where the landowner would get exact notice of what's being done, an exact time frame. Compensation, which we haven't discussed, would be determined on the front end. That mechanism is already there. Had they done that, we wouldn't be here today. They have a mechanism. We don't need to give them these rights that have no basis in common law in this state. None. No basis at all. And that's the test in Palazzolo and Lucas. We ask that you reverse with instructions to declare 2135-31 unconstitutional and find that Summit is not a common carrier transporting commodities for hire. Thank you so much for your time.
Before we wrap up, Mr. Jordy, I'll just have you stand there for a moment.
Yes.
Justice Kern asked about the unredacted copies and those being filed under seal for in-camera review by the court. Do you have any objection to that?
I would welcome that, and I would direct you, if you get the unredacted copy that matches, which SR3 1708, that's section 3.02 of the offtake agreement. It determines who the offtaker is, and that is Summit Carbon. And then you want to look at 1715 in the record, 808.01, the title transfer point, which says they take title.
It's over. They're transporting their own CO2. There's no argument to the contrary. So I welcome you revealing those contracts.
And Mr. Dublinsky, I don't know if you want to you can take a seat.
Oh, thank you.
Mr. Jordy, thank you. I don't know if you have any other response to that, but 10 days to file under seal for in-camera review. Does that give you enough time?
Your Honor, if...
Why don't you come on up to the mic?
Your Honor, if what you're looking for is the exact same thing that was provided to the trial court, which I assume is the point, 10 days should be adequate.
Okay. Come on up, Mr. Green.
Just because this is a little unusual. My only question, and I don't have an answer, I'm thinking as I stand here, is if you're going to get into the unredacted copy to determine property rights and something of that's so momentous, I'm just wondering if it's not appropriate for counsel also to have access to those agreements. Otherwise, there could be an opinion referencing evidence that was never part of the record and would never had an opportunity to respond or review or argue it.
Yeah, so why don't we do this? Why don't you submit under seal, Mr. Belinsky, within 10 days? We'll consider your comments, Mr. Jordy. If we think we need further supplemental briefing or argument, we'll let the parties know.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Otherwise, once we receive that those unredacted copies, the case will be considered under submission. I do want to compliment counsel on your arguments and your briefs and oral arguments. Really well done, and appreciate that. With that, we'll be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.